Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in life, our mind, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. So in this show, I'll bring you the latest research about, oh, is it okay to be fakely nice at work? The quick answer is nope. It worked in many other places, but not in a work environment. And then I will speak to Valerie Alexander, a nationally recognized speaker on the topics of happiness in the workplace, the advancement of women and unconscious bias. And she's the author of the Amazon number one seller, Happiness as a Second Language, along with How Women Can Succeed in the Workplace. So be sure to listen to my podcast in iTunes and Stitcher. Share it with your friends. Give me a review and email me. Go to fujian.com and email me any of the topics that you really like me to talk about or for me to bring a guest. So I'm counting on you to share your views with me. We'll be right back with the tip of the week.
Hello, this is Dr. Fujian Zain. For all of you who are interested in changing something in your life, or shifting a new career, or bettering your intimate relationship, or, you know, it's just time to take care of you, but you really don't have time to take off from your busy day, or you're just too far away from my Beverly Hills or San Clemente office, I have a great offer for you. I'm only offering this time-limited package to you. For online therapy, if you are living in the state of California, or online coaching wherever you live around the world. Now listen, a 10-week package with a $500 discount. Call me to schedule your appointment, 818-648-2140, 818-648-2140, or go to fujian.com, F-O-O-J-A-N.com for more information. It's time to take care of you. Because you are worth it.
So this is the tip of the week. I'm going to tell you how funny this is because I wrote this and I was really pondering on it and I was really looking. So I'm going to read it to you and then tell you why it was funny. So this week I've been working with the concept of waiting to the last minute or not wanting to deal with what you know you have to deal with, and then consequences pile up and hit. Working with students that are leaving their homework and assignments to the last minute and then creating an ample amount of stress for themselves and all others around them to bail them out. Or working with people who know what the assignments are at work and avoid the work since they just don't like that part of their work until they're fired or lose a customer. Working with couples who don't address the lack of intimacy and connection until one looks somewhere else and for companion or sex partner. Get the picture. What areas of life are you avoiding? What types of consequence are you paying and high prices for yourself? In what area are you paying the high prices? So people usually avoid reality at hand, such as procrastinating with homework, paying bills, doing chores, doing paperwork, etc., because they are disinterested to deal with what needs to be done, so they just postpone it to later and usually until the last minute before a deadline of some sort or pay up the harsh consequence. Others avoid addressing what needs to be handled, such as lack of intimacy with their mates, setting boundaries with family members, taking a stand for themselves at work, search for a new career, going to the doctors, and etc., because they might have to face a breakup or a divorce, getting fired, not finding anything better, finding out that they have an illness, and so on. So with all that said, you know that avoiding reality does not just make it go away. It lingers and gets worse until you pay attention and handle it. Usually the consequences gets higher and harsher. So if you need support with dealing with what is in front of you, whether it's to learn new healthy habits, figuring out and facing what needs to be faced, or learning new skills to deal with your worst nightmare, then please get a support and don't wait for the consequences to hit you. Now, the funny concept was, I had signed up for a traffic school because, yes, I got a ticket because, yes, I wasn't speeding. I was actually turning right. And I saw the police and I saw the line, but for some reason I was so occupied about where to go, I just did it anyway. And obviously the policeman came and he said, are you doing this on purpose? Because I saw you looking at me. And I said, to be honest with you, I was so consumed with where I was going. Although my eyes were seeing, I wasn't comprehending. I was just focused on that. Anyway, I got the ticket. And then so I said, I'm going to go to the online traffic school. And I signed up for the online traffic school. Well, I got to tell you a secret. I hate taking tests. I just hate taking exams. So I read all of it. It was great online, a lot of great information. I actually love reading. So I was reading it. I just dreaded the test every time. So then I did half of it. And then I said, forget it. I'm not going to do it for a while. Guess what? Last night, I had to stay until 12 midnight because today was the last day. And I just looked at the irony of everything that I worked this week with all of the people. This was the conversation. And guess who did it exactly that way? Yeah, here, right here. So it's something we all do. And I know that what it is that I didn't want to do, I did not want to face taking a test. I did the test. I got 88 on it, and it was really good. But the concept of having to suffer, I kept putting me back in, you know, that's what happened. So look at what goes on in your life and where is it that you are kind of procrastinating or avoiding. We got to do it anyway, even if it takes until midnight. All right. We'll be right back with the latest research.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
So here is the latest research. The adage, fake it till you make it, the idea that someone can fake a positive attitude to elicit real life benefits, often backfires when used with coworkers, according to a study led by a University of Arizona researcher. Instead, researchers say making an effort to actually feel the emotion you display is more productive. Allison Gabriel, Associate Professor of Management and Organizations in the Eller College of Management, led a team that analyzed two types of emotion regulation that people use at work, surface acting and deep acting. Surface acting is faking what you're displaying to other people. Inside, you may be upset or frustrated, but on the outside, you're trying your best to be pleasant or positive. Deep acting is trying to change how you feel inside. When you're deep acting, you're actually trying to align how you feel with how you interact with people. The study surveyed working adults in a wide variety of industries, including education, manufacturing, engineering, and financial services. Researchers said what we wanted to know is whether people choose to engage in emotion regulation when interacting with their coworkers, why they choose to regulate their emotions if there is no formal rule requiring them to do so, and what benefits, if any, they get out of this effort. When it comes to regulating emotions with coworkers, four types of people emerged from this study. Non-actors, or those engaging in negligible levels of surface and deep acting. Low actors, or those displaying slightly higher surface and deep acting. Deep actors, or those who exhibited the highest levels of deep acting and low levels of surface acting. And regulators, or those who displayed high levels of surface and deep acting. In each study, non-actors made up the smallest group, with the three others being similar in size. The researchers identified several drivers for engaging in emotion regulation and sorted them into two categories, prosocial and impression management. Prosocial motives included wanting to be a good coworker and cultivating positive relationships. Impression management motives are more strategic and included gaining access to resources or looking good in front of your colleagues and supervisors. So the team found that regulators in particular were driven by impression management motives, while deep actors were significantly more likely to be motivated by prosocial concerns. This means that deep regulate their emotions with coworkers to foster positive work relationship as opposed to being motivated by gaining access to more resources. So faking it versus feeling it. The main takeaway, Gabrielle says, is that deep actors, those who are really trying to be positive with the coworkers, do so for pro-social reasons and reap significant benefits from those efforts. According to the researchers, those benefits include receiving significantly higher level of support from coworkers, such as help with workloads and offers of advice. Deep actors also reported significantly higher levels of progress on their work goals and trust in their coworkers than the other three groups. The data also showed that mixing high levels of surface and deep acting resulted in physical and mental strain. Regulators have suffered the most of the markers of well-being, including increased levels of feeling emotionally exhausted and inauthentic at work. Lessons learned. While some managers Gabrielle spoke to during the course of her research still believe emotions have little to do with the workplace, and the study results suggest there is a benefit to displaying positive emotions during interaction at work. Researchers think that the fake it till you make it idea suggests a survival tactic at work, maybe plastering on a smile to simply get out of an interaction is easier in a short run, but long term, it will undermine efforts to improve your health and your relationship you have at work. In many ways, it all boils down to let's be nice to each other. Not only will people feel better, but people's performance and social relationships can also improve. So today I have, we're actually going to talk about work and what happens in the workplace. I'm so excited to have Valerie Alexander with me today, who's a nationally recognized speaker on the topics of happiness in the workplace, the advancement of women and unconscious bias. She's the author of the Amazon number one seller, Happiness as a Second Language, along with How Women Can Succeed in the Workplace, Despite Having Female Brains. So we got to check out with her, what is a female brain? And several more books written and published under her trademark as a second language series. Valerie started her career as a securities lawyer, investment banker, and internet executive in the Silicon Valley, then transitioned to Hollywood, where she enjoys success as a screenwriter and a director, periodically returning to her tech roots as the interim VP of business development at two media startups and the founder and CEO of Goalkeeper, which built communication tools to amplify happiness. She's busy. She's a graduate of Trinity University, UC Berkeley and Berkeley Law, and was Trinity's 2016 commencement speaker. In addition to traveling the world as keynote speaker, Valerie writes Christmas movies for Hallmark Channel, which she knows you secretly love, even though you only admit to watching them with your mom. Hi, Valerie. So nice to have you.
I am so happy to be here with you today.
Oh, my God. What an impressive bio. You are so busy. And you were telling me how busy you were just from like December till now, more and more on things that I didn't even talk about.
Right. All the work in unconscious bias and other things have really, there's a change in the consciousness right now in the country. And so hopefully people are going to start getting these things right.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
So you, obviously you've been in the corporate world, you've created startups, in the corporate world. And you also talked about, in as I was reading your book, about this concept of the female brain, male brain, and this concept that, well, because men started, you know, going out there, creating the commerce, and so a lot of the rules, whether it was the businesses or politics or, you know, whatever was out there, a lot of the rules got created by men. And then when women started going into the workforce, now they own, the only thing they had to do was to adapt to that world versus, you know, necessarily bringing their world in. And I can definitely attest to that from this other experience that whenever I worked in corporate world, you know, I worked in hospitals and, you know, clinical sense, but they were all corporate world. It was a different ambiance, even with women in, if I had like bosses or coworkers, which were women in that world, versus like when I started working in nonprofit organizations, which were women created and women based. And it was such a different world when I went in. And it was a totally a different feel. So tell us about all of these differences.
All of them.
All of them.
So we'll go back. I think we can. We'll just go back just 2 million years, because that's where it all started. Okay. So 2 million years ago, the human species took a giant leap forward in evolution with the Homo habilis. That's the predecessors to Homo sapiens who walked on 2 feet and weren't covered with fur. And habilis represented a giant leap forward because they did a lot of cool things, but the biggest thing they did is they built tools. So all kinds of animals make tools. Monkeys will take the leaves off a branch to brew a stick. But Homo habilis built tools. They sharpened a rock and tied it to a stick and made a spear. When you have a spear, you can hunt bigger animals. And when you can hunt bigger animals, you need more people. Because it takes more people to take down a woolly mammoth. It takes more people to transport the meat back to the cave, and you have a larger territory to protect. So Homo habilis were the first to start living in tribes. And once we started living in tribes, there's a new survival skill now, because typically it was just the survival of the individual and the survival of the offspring. But now they had to be worried about the survival of the tribe. And survival in the biological definition means you have the ability to reproduce yourself. So I always say the definition is you can reproduce yourself and keep your offspring alive until they reach reproductive age. So anyone who has children who have gone through puberty, congratulations, they have survived. But
you're free now.
You're free now. You have survived. Your children have gone through puberty. But what happened tribally is we're all descendants of the tribes that survived. And the tribes that survived were the ones that figured out, don't let the women die. The women are more biologically valuable to the survival of the tribe in raw numbers. If a tribe has 10 men and 10 women and 10 men go off and fight in a war and only 2 come back, that tribe can still reproduce itself.
Yes.
2 men with 10 women will be able to reproduce the entire tribe, and happily for those 2. But if the tribe has 10 men and 10
women... I think polygamists would really like what you say.
Well, it is interesting because it takes many fewer resources to have 1 man and several women. But so if 10 women went off and fight in a war and only 2 come back, the tribe goes away.
Right.
And so, and I'm not saying they sat down and had like a business council and determined this. I'm saying it's just sort of evolution works, where the thing that worked is what survived and the thing that didn't work is what didn't survive.
It was so just too obvious.
Exactly. It just happened that way. But no, so the men who were dispensable, not to say that men were dispensable, but the men were sent to do anything that would cause instant death. So hunting big meat and protecting the cave. That caused instant death. That's what men did. The women stayed back at the cave and did everything else, every single other task to keep the tribal, everything. They skinned the meat. They cooked the food. They cared for the elderly. They raised the children. They took care of the poor. They kept the fire burning. They fished. They foraged. They engaged in early stages of agriculture. They hunted small animals, because the men were often gone for weeks or months at a time. So the women had to be able to do everything else. Because men were the only ones leaving the caves, men were only encountering other men. And so as combat between tribes evolved into commerce between tribes, they were basing it on all those traits that ensured success in hunting and combat, which were quick decision-making, being able to take risk, being able to analyze risk, knowing your place in the hierarchy, knowing who you answer to, who answered to you. These are the traits they brought into the commercial world, into the corporate world. Women, the traits we were developing were multitasking, inclusion, consensus building. We never took risk because if you took a risk, the offspring of the tribe might die.
Right.
And that was too high a risk to take. So when that transition from combat into commerce took place around 10,000 years ago, and women's place in commerce really only started happening about 60 to 70 years ago. And so all those traits that get rewarded in any male-designed enterprise, and I never say male-dominated. Male-dominated seems intentional or mean. It's male-designed. Men designed it, therefore it rewards their natural instincts.
Right.
And so what women have to do, two things. Women have to figure out small adaptations. Never try to behave like men. It's like what you were talking about with the happiness. Don't fake it till you make it in terms of behaving like men. You will never get there. Bring all the value you bring as a woman. We bring so much value as women, so much consensus building and contemplating all angles before making decisions and inclusion. Those are so valuable. But in order to get rewarded, adapt so that you're behaving in the way that gets rewarded. So things like quick decision making, speaking confidently, knowing your place in the hierarchy, respecting it with respect to your boss, owning it with respect to the people who answer to you. These are the core things that we can get more rewarded for because we have different instincts. Men and women have different instincts when it comes to social interaction and emotions and decision-making. Mm-hmm. Because, one last thing, this part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex up here above our eyes, in our foreheads, that didn't exist 2 million years ago. 2 million years ago, when we began living in tribes and we separated our tasks by gender, the human brain was about the size of a meatball. Mm-hmm. So this processing center called the prefrontal cortex evolved itself into existence over those 2 million years, over that period of time where the men who were going to pass their genes on to the next generation, and we know brain activity is hereditary, so we know that the brain activity that caused success was what was getting passed down. The men who were passing their genes on to the next generation were the ones succeeding at hunting and combat. And the women passing our genes on to the next generation were the ones succeeding at the every single other task to keep the tribe alive. After that division took place and the prefrontal cortex evolved itself into existence, we evolved with different instincts for social interaction, control of emotions, and decision making. And that's why women have to adapt slightly, but companies need to adapt a lot more to start rewarding those instinctive female traits that get you better outcomes.
And it seems like the companies are also getting a little bit more interested in their employees' emotions, habits, and what they do. So, for example, we know many of the tech industries, like Google, the campus they're creating is more like, you know, you're gonna work kind of 24 hours,
right?
And then we expect you that you're gonna be knowing what to do. We won't tell you what hours should be. We just want to see the result. And then we'll create a campus where you can socialize, you can take a nap, you can play games, you can really create happiness for yourself, and then also feed the bigger picture and, you know, create your creativity. So, and you have moved your kind of like research and speaking and writing into the happiness that comes in the workplace.
Right.
So, what creates the, let's go to the other side. What creates the unhappiness that brought you into this question of now let's look at the happiness?
Well, I have a theory. There are a lot of things that make people happy and unhappy at work. There are three long-ranging workplace happiness studies in this country, one at Harvard Business School, one at UC Riverside, and one for Gallup. Gallup organization does workplace happiness. And they all came to the exact same conclusion about what creates happiness, which is UC Riverside calls it your sense of accomplishment. Gallup calls it getting to put your skills to work effectively. And Harvard calls it the ability to make progress on work that matters. All anybody wants to do at work every day is get things done. Like that's what fuels us. That's what fills your tank when you go into work, not the foosball table or the free lunch. It's that you went into work and you did something and you made a difference. One of the reasons I was only an investment banker for 10 months is because I could never figure out what investment bankers were contributing to society. My days were filled, but I couldn't figure out anything of value that I was creating or doing. And I just couldn't stand that. It made me so miserable. And so one of the things we do to people is we rob them of their sense of accomplishment. We give people an endless to-do list. You just mentioned Google. Google has all the amenities and benefits and paper happiness you could ask for. And yet, the average tenure of a new hire at Google is still 14 months.
Wow.
And part of that is that Google used to, they've gotten away from this because they figured out how wrong this was. They used to literally refer to their hiring process as hazing. And think about the kind of people you're going to attract when that is how you choose to hire. When you choose to, how you hire somebody affects them throughout their entire career. They will remember what happened in their interviews. And if it's destabilizing, if it takes away their confidence, if it makes them feel unwelcome, you've dug yourself into a hole that you have to get out of. So if I had to pick one thing that causes the greatest amount of unhappiness in every workplace, and I go into a lot of workplaces and talk about this, it is what I call accidental managers.
Say more. Accidental managers.
Accidental manager. People become accidental managers in one of two ways. Either they're managers without anybody realizing that they are managers. This happens a lot with doctors. You worked with doctors, right?
Yes.
How many doctors had people who answer to them? Mm-hmm. Every doctor has people who answer to them, right? Have any doctors you've ever worked with gotten managerial training?
Only as a reactive concept, where they really screwed up and they saw how bad it is, and then finally took maybe one course.
Right. It isn't taught in med school. How to manage. No. I spoke at a university to their staff and faculty, and at a point I asked, in talks I have different moments where this one I asked, how many people in this room are managers? And a lot of hands went up, but a lot of hands didn't go up, including a table of chemistry professors in the back of the room. And so I said to them, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize the university didn't give you a lab. And these chemistry professors were ranged from shocked to offended. They're, what are you talking about? I said, none of you has a lab. And of course, every one of them had a lab. And I went around the table. One of them had a lab that had 30 people working in it, undergrads and grad students and postgrads. And I said, you don't see yourself as a manager? You have 30 people who answer to you. And so that's one level of accidental managers. People we don't even realize. And that is scientists and engineers and lawyers and doctors. People who are in charge of other people without us ever realizing that that's a role that they possess. The other kind of accidental managers are people that we put into managerial roles. We know that they're in charge of other people. And they've never been given 1 minute of managerial training.
Yeah.
They got put in charge of other people because of their title or their education or their seniority, or God forbid, they were next in line. And nobody stopped to think, hey, do you actually know how to motivate people? Do you know how to talk to the people who answer to you? Do you know how to make people feel valued? That we allow a lot of accidental moments in workplaces. We do a lot of accidental hiring.
I can tell you very, very clearly that I have been even accidental in all of the corporate world that I did, because I went into management very quickly. Mm-hmm. Same thing. None of that. I mean, I went to personal growth seminars, which weren't even for management. It was just I was growing. So I was attempting whatever I was growing to share it. And then I started my own company, you know, Personal Growth Institute. I had like 60 therapists and supervisors and all of that. And I can tell you still that the level of management that I have been doing, had been doing for so many years, I should have really studied a whole, you know, gotten a whole master's or PhD about it, and I never did. And I was frustrated with some of the things that I just, you know, although I'm in the field of therapy and psychology, but it was very different when you actually have to hold people accountable for things versus being a therapist where, you know, I share my suggestions and people choose to do or not to do. Is a very different way of being with people, where not only you need to motivate them, care for them to know you care for them, but also hold all of those boundaries while you hold them accountable to every single, you know, output that they have to do. And you're absolutely right. I think most of the people, what you call accidental managers, are not being trained for that.
I think it's so hard. I so admire that you hit a point where you said, this is something I need to learn how to do, or you were taking seminars to try to get better at it. But there are so many layers of skill set involved to be both the supervisor and the, you know, counselor and the motivator. Those are hard things to do all at once. When I go and speak to at a company or a conference, usually giving a keynote or sometimes doing a seminar or workshop, I have some pretty basic techniques I share that just even the most minimal things that people were never taught. Here's the biggest one. Not the biggest one. I have a big one that I'll share. But one big one is acknowledge in public, admonish in private. If you have to correct somebody, do it behind a closed door. If it might be a sensitive topic, maybe have someone from HR in there or someone else in the room, but don't do it in front of their colleagues or their clients. I say this so many, in every room I'm in, I ask, how many of us has ever been in a business that wasn't our company where we saw somebody else getting yelled at while we were there? I saw it happen in my veterinarian's office. I had a veterinarian who yelled at her nurse in front of me, and I thought, oh, maybe it's just a bad day. And then happened a second time. And then I was like, I need to find a different veterinarian. Mm-hmm. Because I know I can't say as a patient, my dog was the patient, as a client, she's creating an unhappy workplace. And that unhappy workplace is going to filter into how those people do their jobs, and how those people do their jobs affects the life of my dog. So I seek happy workplaces on everything important. Mm-hmm. I had a LASIK eye surgery. I had my vision corrected. And that was the one thing I asked I interviewed a bunch of different eye centers, and I asked, what's the turnover? How long have people been here? Do you have any absenteeism problems? And I think they thought these were the weirdest questions ever. Mm-hmm. Turnover and absenteeism are your two biggest benchmarks for the happiness of your employees. That is the canary in the coal mine. And if you have high turnover and high absenteeism, you have an unhappy workforce. And there is no way on this earth I was going to let my eyes get operated on in a place where anybody was unhappy.
Mm-hmm. The point you're telling me, I've done it myself and I've learned through it. And I remember I used to have a therapist who used to work for me in my center, and we had a very great bond. Like I was her supervisor for a long time. So, you know, as a supervisor, I was teaching her the therapy. So she was, you know how you have like the teacher student relationship, and it was great. And then she decided to stay in our center and become a therapist. So one time, her whole behavior at one point changed. And I remember at one point, I asked her, I said, what's going on? Something in our relationship changed. And, you know, you're more isolative and you're kind of like not. And she turned around and said, I don't know how to say this to you, but I'm going to risk it and say it. But I felt very betrayed by you. And I was like, betrayed by me? And, you know, obviously we're all therapists, so we talk that way. And I'm like, why? What did I do? And obviously, to me, I haven't done anything wrong, because obviously I didn't want to do anything. Not that right. I didn't want to do anything, but I never did anything intentionally. So I figured if I didn't do it intentionally, then obviously I didn't do anything wrong. And she said that. She says, because you were my teacher and you were always in the role of giving me feedback, so it wasn't like I wasn't going to take feedback from you, but you said it in a way in front of other people that I felt really demeaned. Yeah. And from there on, I just, you know, figured you're no longer safe and I wasn't going to be close to you. And that just shocked me.
Wow.
Shocked me. Yeah. And I really, you know, admired her for her courage and, you know, vulnerability, the courage to share her vulnerability. And our relationship, and I apologize, our relationship got really better after that. But that really showed me, and I, you know, even now, as I've closed down my centers and all of that, you know, my relationship with the therapists are so bonded. Like, we still have a WhatsApp group, we share stuff, we give each other clients. But those, I had to learn each one of those really in a trial and error. And some of them I paid high prices, because there were people who weren't as vulnerable or courageous for her to tell me, and they just left the center hating me afterward.
Which, yeah, this is one of the things I say all the time. No one in the history of mankind has ever told the truth in an exit interview.
Yes.
Yeah. And so the things we have to find out the hard way can be really painful. There's also easy ways to create happiness. So I want to share some of those, just because if anybody listening is thinking, "Ooh, I'm in a managerial role. What am I getting wrong? What can I do?" There's two big ones. One of the worst things we do to our employees or the people who answer to us is we take away their sense of accomplishment by changing the goal line. You tell somebody, do A and B, and they do A and they're halfway through B, and you come over and you're like, "Okay, now do D and E." And wait a minute. You never gave them the accomplishment of finishing that. That's one thing. Or every workplace responds to what I call the tyranny of the urgent. I didn't create that phrase. That's common. The tyranny of the urgent, which is something normal is happening in the workday, and then something goes wrong, and everybody has to go pay attention to what went wrong. Mm-hmm. So the boss comes over to an employee and says, "Hey, stop that. Go fix that." And the boss knows the priorities. When you are higher than someone on a ladder, you have a better view. And so the boss knows the priorities and doesn't realize that hasn't been translated to the employee. And the worker just hears, "I'm doing something wrong," or "maybe I caused that problem," which they probably didn't. And then they're so destabilized, because even if they drop what they're doing and go fix that other problem, now they don't know, was I supposed to go back to what I was doing? Am I off the hook for that? You know, employees are not capable of prioritizing on their own. We just can't put that work on them. It's not fair. The manager gets paid more because it requires more mental energy to be the manager, because mental energy is mental labor and mental labor is labor. Mm-hmm. So if you're the manager, do the mental energy of prioritizing for your employees. And if you have to change somebody's task, or if you have to add a task to their to-do list when they haven't got a chance to complete what you've already given them, here's how that communication goes. You can either walk up to them and say, "Hey, stop that. Go work on that." Or you can say, "Hey, thanks for what you're working on. That other thing is more important, and I need you to work on that first because I know you can handle it. When you're done with that, please come back and finish this." Now, that took longer. That took 10 seconds to say instead of 2 seconds to say. But saying it that way is going to save you 2 or 3 sick days this year. It's going to save you that employee walking out unexpectedly. And people always say to me, "I'm never going to remember that," because it's, you lead with appreciation. The first thing you say is appreciation. "Thanks for what you're working on." Then you give them clear directions. "I need you to go do that other task. And when you're done with that, just go home. Don't worry about this other thing. Or when you're done with that, please come back and finish this." Whatever it is, your clear directions are really helpful to your employees. And then express confidence in their work. People give you what you expect of them. If you expect excellence, you will get excellence. If you expect dishonesty, you will get dishonesty. Definitely. Adjust your mentality towards your employees so that you are expecting what you want and you will start getting it. So again, that's a lot to remember. So I have a little shorthand for it, which is you rock your employees with ACDC, which is appreciation, clear directions, and confidence in their abilities. And if all of your communication is with appreciation, clear direction, and confidence in their abilities, your employees will be so much happier. Definitely. They will give you so much more. They will come back day in and day out. And then the other thing I tell people in management, and I'm amazed at how resistant managers are to this. I just was speaking at an event yesterday where I was sharing this one-on-one with somebody, and he was like, oh, that wouldn't work in my department. I was like, why would that be your response? So here's the thing that seems weird and it seems funny. Stick with it. I promise you, stick with it. If you have direct reports in your workplace, people who report directly to you, at the end of every month, call each of one of them into your office one by one, just one at a time, close the door and say, hi, hey, we don't have an employee of the month here. That's a policy we don't have. But if we did, if we had employee of the month and you were going to be getting it for the past month, what would that be for? What did you do in the last month for which we would want to give you employee of the month? Now, the first time you ask this, your employees are going to feel like that's a little weird. They're going to be resistant to sharing anything with you. But whatever they tell you, just write it down. Just write it down. Make notes. Yes, this is okay. Got it. Thank you. Don't dispute them. Just say thank you. That's great. I'm happy to know that. Then by the following month you do that, they're going to be ready for it. And they'll probably have something to tell you. By the third month, while they're working, they're going to be thinking of things like, oh, this is my employee of the month thing. Cool. And by the fourth month, they will try to be doing things that they can tell you about. Now, there are giant advantages to doing this.
Definitely.
Yeah. One of them is at the end of the year, you now have 12 specific points that you know, like you don't have to, your annual review is a lot easier.
Oh, yeah.
When you have 12 things written down already.
They're evaluating themselves and all the positive things that they've done.
100%. That's one. Number two, you will start to get interesting excuses sometimes. Mm-hmm. Well, what I tried to do this month was X, but I didn't have the tools to do it. That's a great piece of information to have as a manager. Another thing you will get is four different people taking the credit for the same task that maybe only one person actually did. See, here's something else that makes us unhappy in our workplaces, and it is universally true everywhere in the world, in every environment. Every person thinks they're contributing more than they actually are and thinks everyone else is contributing less than they actually are.
Yeah.
And so that is a really good thing to figure out early on. If you have four people working on the same project and every one of them is taking credit for every part of the project, there's a communication issue on your team and you can fix it a lot earlier. You can fix it before it becomes resentment, before it becomes bitter, before somebody just starts calling in sick or checking out.
Right.
So, and then I tell some companies, and if you want to do something with this, publish all of them at the end of every month and say, here's our employees of the month and have everybody's name and, you know, have a newsletter with all of what everybody contributed, or take each one and fold it up and put it in a basket and draw a card for $100 Amazon gift card every month or something. Mm-hmm. There are things you can do to make your employees feel recognized.
Definitely.
Yeah. Again, I say when I do the talk, the AAA, when you're broken down on the side of the road, you call AAA.
Right.
The AAA of workplace happiness is accomplishment. And accomplishment. Give your employees a sense of accomplishment, acknowledgement. Make sure they feel that their work is being seen by somebody. Mm-hmm. And the third is autonomy. If you give someone a task to do that they are capable of doing, let them do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let them do it.
We have about 5 minutes to 6 minutes. What I wanted to ask you also, because I really don't want us to pass by this conversation, which is the gender bias that you've been talking a lot about. Share a little bit more about that with us.
So I approach bias from a evolutionary biology and brain science perspective, which is your brain causes the release of cortisol in your bloodstream when you encounter anything that is unexpected, anything that is not normal. This is what kept the human species alive for hundreds of millions of years, or however long you want to say the human species has been around. This is what kept us alive, this instantaneous instinctive response. We see something that is not normal, it releases cortisol into our bloodstream, which puts us on high alert, which triggers fight or flight. And that's a good thing. That was a good thing. That we get on high alert. The problem is what we perceive as normal is shaped by a slew of factors, like how we were raised, experiences we've had or never had with people who are different from us, the media images we've been fed our whole lives. And if you have a human brain, you have bias. Everybody listening or watching, if you have a human brain, you have bias. The insidious nature of unconscious bias isn't the bias part. Brains need bias to function. Mm-hmm. It's the unconscious part. And what I try to work with people to help them understand is you have the ability to overcome that bias. You have to do it consciously. You have to acknowledge that the bias is happening. Sometimes you have to hang a lantern on it. You have to spot it in order to stop it. So if somebody walks into your office for an interview, or it's a client coming in for a meeting, or it's a new doctor that you haven't met in person, and it's not, that person does not look like anything you were expecting, don't deny that your body had a stress response, that your body released cortisol into your bloodstream. And take a moment, step away if you have to. If you have to say, excuse me, I'm going to run to the restroom a second. Take a moment, step away, take a deep breath. And if everyone in the sound of my voice could do it right now, just take a deep breath and you go. You feel everything get more relaxed. A deep breath on its own reduces cortisol. Mm-hmm. And when you can reduce the cortisol, you can actively overcome the bias. And when you actively overcome the bias, you do better, the difference will be tangible. And one of the most important things we can do is start changing what we see as normal. So, excuse me, hire the people who don't look like everybody else in your workplace, patronize the businesses, vote for the candidates who are challenging the norms, who are qualified for those roles, but are challenging the norms. Because if we change what is seen as normal, we will change the world.
In 5 minutes, perfect.
Thank you.
What is it that, going back to women, what is it that you can share with the women that they can know how to become successful? And what would you share with the men in the workforce who are either hiring or they have a boss as a female or a coworker or someone who works for them, in what to also see in the value of the women?
Absolutely. The biggest thing for women in the workplace, confidence and competence are perceived as the same trait. If you are highly competent and you behave without confidence, you will be perceived as incompetent. And so this is where fake it till you make it works. Just behave with confidence. Because people who are highly confident can go years before anyone figures out whether or not they're competent. So that's number one. Make a decision quickly. If there's a decision to be made, make it. If you are 85% sure you're right, you're right. Do that with a client on the phone. When a client calls you and asks a question, if you're 90% sure you know the answer, give them the answer. And then if you're wrong, then you hang up and then you go look it up and find out if you were right. When you're right, great. Issue done. No further phone calls. If you're wrong, you call back. And when you call back, you say, hey, I looked into that further. Here's what you need to do. You don't call back and say, oh my God, I'm so stupid. I should have never told you that. We have to speak with the language of success. If you're in a meeting and you want to contribute something, you don't open your contribution with, I might be wrong, but I think we need to do this. Or would everyone agree that we need to have a marketing meeting on Tuesday? No. You say, here's what I think. We need to have our marketing meeting on Tuesday. So here's what I think is a way to announce that what you're about to say has value. It gets everyone to look up from their phone and realize that someone is speaking. That's why you pause. Here's what I think.
This shows up for me as something that I've seen on as comments, and I just wanted to share that with you. Within, we probably only have like 1 or 2 minutes, really short. Unfortunately, I think that this type of an assertiveness, when it happens through the man's world and sharing, it is taken as confident. Many times the same demeanor, when it comes from the women's world, it appears more aggressive. And then it's right. Kind of like shunned upon and obviously labeled, you know. But more than anything, it appears so much more forceful when it shows up as that. What do you think about that?
This is completely true, that confidence from women is often misperceived as aggression. But it also happens because we are so, I always say to women, if you're speaking that way, if you're overly assertive and you're saying, look, guys, this is what we have to do. Or if you're saying, okay, I might be wrong. Everyone should agree with me, but let's do this. Both of those are two sides of the same thing. And both of those are the result of women swimming against the current. The workplace doesn't reward your natural instincts. And when you are in a place that doesn't reward your natural instincts and you're swimming against the current, what happens is you look over at the guy swimming in the current and you think, well, damn, that's a good swimmer. I wish I could swim like that. Yeah. But I'm saying, if you've been swimming against the current your whole career, you're the stronger swimmer. So you'll notice the way I said it was, here's what I think. Mm-hmm. Or women have to give themselves credibility sometimes. So we're listened to, right? If you're going to do that, do it in 10 words or less. Don't list your whole CV. This is what I say when I have something to say to contribute. I say, well, I'm actually an expert on the brain science behind this. And here's what I think.
Got it. Valerie Alexander, everyone, where can they find you, Valerie?
The best place is at speakhappiness.com. So that's my website, speakhappiness.com. Or if you want to reach out to me directly, it's info@speakhappiness.com. Also on Facebook and Instagram and all that. But to reach me directly, the best place is info@speakhappiness.com.
Thank you so much for taking the time in your busy day. I know you're going so fast on all the things you needed to do. So thank you for being with me.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
Thank you. For everyone who's out there listening and viewing, guys, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.